afternoon that one day, men will no longer burn down houses in the church of God simply because people want to be free. I have a dream this afternoon that there will be a day that we will no longer face the atrocities that Emmett Till had to face or Medgar Evers had to face, but that all men can live with dignity. I have a dream this afternoon that my four little children will not come up in the same young days that I came up within, but they will be judged on the basis of the content of their character, not the color of their skin. I have a dream this afternoon that one day right here in Detroit, Negroes will be able to buy a house or rent a house anywhere that their money will carry them, and they will be able to get a job. Yes, I have a dream this afternoon that one day in this land the words of Amos will become real. Justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I have a dream this evening that one day we will recognize the words of Jefferson that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I have a dream this afternoon.
Oh, Robert, you leave me in this unfortunate position where I must terminate this speech before its conclusion, because it's 1:30, and we must present our next program here at WBAI New York, which is Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund at 3 o'clock. Lister, or a reasonable facsimile, but now it's Hour of the Wolf here on WBAI New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, writer Catherine Lundoff appears, courtesy of recording. Well, actually, the whole show is recorded this week. Stay tuned, and I'll explain the whole thing. Thank you. And once again, good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and I have pre-recorded this show today, same day as broadcast, for a number of reasons, one of which is that the main part of the show was pre-recorded already, and it just, well, it became a lot easier to fit into my week this way. But let us not be timely as a result, double negatives notwithstanding. First, let me do a couple of announcements here. Next Wednesday, that would be a week from tonight, even though this is technically Thursday morning, on April 17th, at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series, two wonderful writers, Richard Bowes. Rick Bowes, if you were listening to the show last week, you know how good he is. And, well, there's just no not going. Here I am again. It's double negative day. Rick Bowes, winner of two World Fantasy Awards, an International Horror Guild Award, and a Million Writer Award. Recent and forthcoming short story appearances include the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, Icarus, Lightspeed, and the anthologies Ghosts, Reason, Haunting. Oh, just tons and tons of books. His latest stuff is that he has out now, which he read on the air last week, and you can still find on the WBAI archive, The Queen, The Cambion, and Seven Others, which is a collection of short stories, his classic novel, Minions of the Moon, and then finally, If Angels Fight. Not finally, but I mean, just all this stuff is coming out now. So do go meet Rick. And actually, I believe I will be there as well. Usually Gordon Linsner has been covering these for me because it's very difficult for me to go to the KGB readings and then wait, you know, 4 or 5 hours after that, hang out and go do the radio show. It was difficult enough when it was at 120 Wall Street. But now that we're up at CCNY on 130 umpteenth Street, it's even harder. But this one I intend to get to. Why? I'll explain that in a minute as well. The other reader is also a frequent guest to Hour of the Wolf, although it's been a little while for her, Aliyah Dawn Johnson, who is the author of the Spirit Binders series, which included Racing the Dark in the Burning City, and also the Zephyr Hollis novels, Moonshine and Wicked City. So if you love your 1920s speakeasy stories with a bit of vampirism thrown in, those are the ones for you. Her first official young adult book, The Summer Prince, is just out. Kirkus gave it fine, quote, luminous review. And she's currently following up on a follow-up YA novel. And again, this information is good for next Wednesday night, April 17th at 7 p.m. at the KGB Bar, 85 East 4th Street, which is just off of 2nd Avenue upstairs. I hope to be there recording it. If I'm not recording it, Gordon Linsner will be, but we'll be there. And admission is free. I advise showing up early because these things do fill up, and with a lineup like that, well, why not? Now, why can I make it to that reading next week and not generally make it to the KGB readings? Well, our transmitter, the WBAI transmitter, will be off. But wait, hold your fear. This is not related in any way, shape, or form to the famed or infamous WBAI transmitter fund and the problems that we have been facing on that. This is Empire State Building maintenance. This happens every few years. When I was on the air from 5 to 7 a.m., it never affected me because the transmitter generally comes back on a little before 5 a.m. It goes off at 1 a.m. and comes back about 5 for 4 or 5 nights in a row. Occasionally, they only do 3 nights and then we come back early. It's an unknown. But now that I am on in this time slot, Wednesday night, Thursday mornings, 1:30 till 3 a.m., all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, we always had to do that. What a pain. Anyway, so we're off the air. Hour of the Wolf is off the air at least next week. That's the bad news. And the good news is that I'll be able to make it to the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading again. So let's see. The next NYRSF reading, that's my reading series, the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, will be, by the way, May 7th, and I will tell you much more about that as the date approaches. Okay, now our guest this morning is Catherine Lundoff from Minneapolis. She had originally contacted me about getting an opportunity to do a New York Review of Science Fiction reading, as a matter of fact. And I said, well, we're a little bit booked up on that, but hey, how about a radio show? We get 30 or 40 people coming to the NYRSF reading, sometimes more. Got to have at least as many listening to the radio, and she was quite good with that. And actually, she's a bit of an old hand at being a guest on radio programs. She had just been on KFAI for International Working Women's Day. KFAI is the Minneapolis listener-sponsored radio station. Not a Pacifica affiliate, I don't believe, but nonetheless, a fine, fine station that also, by the way, has a presence of science fiction in its programming with shows produced by Dave Rom, who's been there for many, many years. And Catherine, like Rick Bowes, who was with us last week, this is totally coincidental, is a person who has books published from Lethe Press. That's L-E-T-H-E, which is edited by Steve Berman. And she has 5 books currently in print. I'm looking at her website right now, and it says, listen to her International Women's Day show, Witches, Werewolves, and Starship Captains. I mean, what's not to like about that? And that also featured Rachel Pollack, another favorite friend here at WBAI Radio. To find out more about her website and such things, she is at CatherineLundoff.com. CatherineLundoff. This interview was recorded on March 9th. She will read a complete short story of a Poe nature, Poe as in the raven, etc., and then a segment from the second book in her werewolf novel series. The first one was Silver Moon, so we'll get a tease for book number 2. So, without further ado, set your Wayback Machine and enjoy the interview. It's about 2:30 in the afternoon in Brooklyn, and today is March 9th of 2013. And I am Jim Freund, and with me is Catherine. And I should have asked how to pronounce your name properly before now. Lundoff or Lundoff?
Lundoff. Lundoff.
Okay, yeah. I recently interviewed a person of Icelandic origin. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the S-N-A-E-R is Snyer. Well, of course it is. So
I'm just thrilled you didn't make it Hoff, because a lot of people do. But, yeah, it's Lundoff, not Lundhoff.
Okay. So. And you are a primarily fantasy or a science fiction and fantasy writer?
Primarily fantasy.
Primarily fantasy.
I've done fantasy. I've done some historicals as well. I'm sort of dabbling in mystery, so... Mm-hmm. But fantasy is probably where I would say the heart lives.
You're based out of Minneapolis.
I am based out of Minneapolis, but I am actually from here originally.
From Brooklyn, though.
From Brooklyn.
Not just from here, but yeah. Practically here.
Born in Park Slope, and now, spent my formative years, as it were, in Bay Ridge. So, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Tell me how you would describe yourself overall. I started with a little bit of identification for the listeners. It's fair to say that you don't write a great deal of right-wing kind of stuff.
No. I come from a very progressive background. I've spent, you know, years as an activist working on different kinds of issues. I spent a lot of time...
Which we wouldn't know from NBA.
No, of course not.
There are people that would say that, actually, but sorry, go on.
I've spent some time living in Central America. I did a lot of Central America solidarity work back in the day. I've traveled around a great deal. I've worked a lot with different feminist organizations, with different LGBTQ organizations. And currently, I'm a board member for Broad Universe, which is an organization that promotes women writing science fiction, fantasy, and horror, as well as the reading of women writing science fiction, fantasy, and horror. We organize a lot of convention events, podcasts, a whole range of really interesting activities. And I'm one of the founding members of Outer Alliance, which is an organization that promotes LGBTQ writers and allies producing positive portrayals of gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, and queer characters within science fiction and fantasy and horror, as well as in the comic industry, gaming, and so forth. And we're kind of much more loosely affiliated than Broad Universe is, but we're doing some interesting work, and I'm hoping to see that grow over time as well.
Yeah.
I'm also one of the guests this year at a convention called Diversicon, ironically enough, which takes place in St. Paul, and that'll be the first weekend in August, and we'll have a group of us talking about the different organizations, Broad Universe, Outer Alliance, and the Carl Brandon Society, which works to promote positive portrayals of people of color as well as to promote the work of writers of color within genre. So that is some of what I do.
Yeah, I it's a horrible thing to say that I had recently a breakthrough in having one of the first Asian writers, Ken Liu, who's a great writer, and thinking about it, it's like, okay, how many Asian writers have I had? Of science fiction, fantasy, etc. The years, and they are sort of where black writers were 20 years ago.
I can remember Nala Hopkinson and I once sat around at a convention and counted all of the writers we could think of, and this was about, close to 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And we didn't run out of fingers, let's just put it that way.
Yeah. The submarine just landed. Yes, but Cherie Renee Thomas changed all that, I say.
I think she did a lot of work that was really valuable, and those are some great books. One of my all-time favorite stories is in the first Dark Matter anthology.
Which is that?
It's by a writer named Amma Patterson, who's local.
I haven't seen her since day before yesterday, but go on. And Amma, if you're hearing this, it's time for you to come back on the show. It's been too long. Sorry.
She has a fabulous, fabulous story of the first Dark Matter anthology.
She read that on the air.
Yes.
And
it's a great
story. She has a voice. She has a voice for reading, and she can do voices. Mm-hmm. And to look at her, you wouldn't know that she's this sharp lawyer. She's amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, and Amma is certainly one of the people I was introduced to by Dark Matter, as many people. And Dark Matter also served the purpose of not only opening up the genre to people of color to submit to, but also identified people who have been writing what could be considered genre. Who knew that Eugene V. Debs wrote SF? And most importantly, I think that book was responsible to change a lot of people of color from being just fans to becoming writers.
Mm.
They weren't submitting. I'd go to science fiction conventions. I'd see people of color, but they weren't writing.
Mm.
They were audience.
Or they weren't getting published, which is another matter altogether.
No, they weren't writing.
Mm.
Really. And if they weren't being published, it's because the people who were submitting, and I say this as a former slush pile reader, it wasn't very good. It wasn't of professional quality. Mm-hmm. Now there, you know, it has totally changed. It's not just fanfic. Mm-hmm. It's you know, the stuff that is going out there, the best writers are diverse writers, in my humble opinion. Mm-hmm. So, although they now have all the problems that all the other science fiction writers have, which is, even if you're N.K. Jemisin, you still have to earn a living.
Yes, yes, sadly.
You know, or Ken Liu, who is a litigator in Boston, or Nora Jemisin is a psychologist here in Brooklyn, and so forth. So now they're all in the mid-list because they decided to write speculative fiction. Mm. Why did you?
I've been a fan for many years, and I started out in fandom, and I started out in fandom in probably the mid-80s in St. Louis, which is when I was going to college, and I started, I was playing a lot of D&D back then. I was hanging out with the physics department at my college, and spent a lot of
time
getting introduced.
Why is it always the hard science people
play
D&D?
Always the hard science people. The thing is, I my degrees are in anthropology and history, ironically enough, but we spent a lot of time playing D&D, and I got introduced to, you know, Steel Eye Span and Fairport Convention, and I had read some science fiction and fantasy. My mother is a big Michael Moorcock and Robert E. Howard fan, if you can sort of try to splice that together.
I can see that.
And so I had, you know, read a fair amount
of
stuff.
They're both from Texas.
There we go, that
works.
At this point.
I mean, different accents.
Slightly, yes.
But Linda Moorcock's from Texas, so Michael moved.
Ah, okay.
To the Moorcock Ranch.
Wow, I don't think I knew that.
What is now the Moorcock Ranch? Well, yeah, quite a few years ago I interviewed him. Mm. He's this proper British gentleman we were... and, you know, on a sunny day carrying the umbrella and all that. Mm-hmm. And his wife was sitting there during the interview rather, you know, quietly. It was his interview and all that. And then I said, but tell me something, you know, after all the Cherry Cornelius, after all this oh-so-British writing, why is it that you live in Texas? And... he looked at his wife, and she said, right on mic, because I got just too damn tired of the weather in London. So, and I think that sort of explains it all.
Well, back then, they
Robert
weren't
E. Howard
both
had,
in Texas.
Robert E. Howard had less choice in the matter.
Yeah,
but Robert E. Howard was also strangely progressive in his way, as is Moorcock. Wasn't he? Maybe you know more.
Howard did some interesting portrayals. I think, by and large, much of his work is a product of its time. However, I will say that he wrote some very memorable female characters. Dark Agnes is actually one of my favorites. That's actually from his non-fantasy, but his historical series. Mm-hmm. And she was a very interesting protagonist. And it's very difficult to track down the one collected book of the short stories about her.
Yeah.
But it was recently, somebody did a full collection of all of Howard's short work, and it's included in that. Those three stories are included in that.
I'll have to look for that.
The first one is the best, but, you know, they make for an interesting read. She's going to be essentially bartered off in an arranged marriage. So she guts her bridegroom on the altar and then escapes and goes off to become a professional sword fighter in Paris or London. I don't remember which. And it's actually modeled very loosely on the career of an actual woman who did something like that. She ended up being a professional opera singer in Paris in the 16th century. And dueling on the streets for money on the side, and she ran off with a nun from Avignon, and there was great to-do about that, and at one point Louis XIV sort of temporarily banished her off to Belgium for dueling on the grounds of Versailles. So, interesting stuff.
I love history.
History's cool.
Yes, yeah, history's very cool. I'm more interested in Howard than his writing.
I can see that.
Yeah.
I can see that.
His writing is, you know, produced governors in California. It's about all the good it's done. And I say that, I just realized that people might take that seriously, so. No, it had its points. It had mm-hmm. its points. It spawned, that's a good word, a lot of interesting other stuff. And he was, but he's a product of his time.
Yeah, I mean, his parallels Lovecraft. I mean, that would be kind of the same general in terms of that kind of influence, you know, on the genre and the kind of...
Ah, but Lovecraft was a hateful, hateful human being.
Well, you know, I'm not going to argue with that. I'm just, you know, saying that in terms of, you know, impact overall in the genre, in terms of what yeah. their work inspired rather than anything yeah. that they, you know, may have personally espoused yeah. or not espoused.
And for those who don't know who Robert E. Howard is, we, you know, one word, Conan.
Yeah.
And then not the late night
yeah.
guy. Different kind of hair.
Mm-hmm.
So...
considerably more skin, too, as I recall.
yeah. So your writing
mm-hmm.
is primarily fantasy,
yep.
as we were saying. And your most current book at the time of this recording is Silver Moon.
It is.
And is what I think is one of the best women's tropes. Has become that finally in the last 20 years, which it wasn't earlier, which is, well, what's more natural to women than werewolves? That monthly problem that can occur. And that's sort of where Silver Moon starts taking off. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. Silver Moon is about a woman who changes into a werewolf right after she enters menopause.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to play with that notion for a variety of reasons. One, there are very, very few middle-aged female protagonists or elderly female protagonists in genre. There's a few, but I can list them all without running out of fingers and toes. So I wanted, that was something I wanted to work with. And I had just sat through Ginger Snaps, which is, there's Ginger Snaps 1, and there's Ginger Snaps 2, and there's a Ginger Snaps prequel as well. And they're this series of Canadian films about these two sisters, one of whom turns into a werewolf, and the other one is trying to cure her. And they're very interesting. They're really well done. You know, I heartily recommend them. But they're part of this small subgenre that Susie McKee-Charnas plays with as well,
yes.
of young women turning into werewolves right around the time of their first menses. And there's
Alyssa
a fair
Shepley
number. There's YA, you know, stuff about this. There's a lot of things on the theme. And I thought, well, you know, if at one change of life, why not another?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so I'm working on a trilogy. The first one is Silver Moon, and I'm working on a new book now, which is called Blood Moon. It'll be the second one, and that'll be it's kind of more of a murder mystery. And I haven't really gotten to the point where I've started to plot out the third one yet. But
mm-hmm.
I'm going to get a little further into book two before I really
talk about it. But it's going to probably have the word moon in the
title. It's going to have the word moon in the title, and
blank
it's going
moon,
to be,
yeah.
you know, many of the same characters, you know, are going to go through the same story arc. And, because, yes, as I was writing the first book, it, you know, was like, I realized I wasn't ready to let go of them, and they weren't ready to let go of me, and I wanted to keep playing with it and see what else I could come up with and what other situations they were going to get into.
When you were growing up, who were your favorite writers?
Oh, wow. You know, it varied different stages of my life, I can say. You know, I really liked Lewis Carroll when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked... You know, as I got older, as you know, I became a teenager, I discovered Ursula Le Guin, and I hit Marion Zimmer Bradley in my teens, which is, you know, a highly influential time, sort of like, you know, I think the equivalent of Heinlein for boys.
Mm-hmm.
I read Heinlein, didn't really speak to me. You know, and it took, I mean, until
not
I
not even
in,
the juveniles?
No.
Because it is shocking to me how many... feminist and gay women I
mm-hmm.
know
yep.
who think that Heinlein is tops.
Yes,
and
I do run across that.
How can... I don't get it. I don't get it. I enjoy Heinlein. I'm a boy.
Even as a teenager, I could look at it and go, wish fulfillment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I understand the appeal. I understand why it speaks to other people. But no, I can't say that it did. You know, Bradley, I think, you know, was not necessarily a better writer, but was playing with things from a much more, you know, female perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I got into, you know, Shattered Chain and Thendara House and so forth, and the various Darkover books, you know, it was something that spoke to me for a time.
And Darkover is a lot of fun. And yeah. Certainly in its day. And
oh, yeah.
And there were Darkover conventions
still
in
are.
New York.
There still is a Darkover convention. I believe it's in Baltimore, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
There's a Darkover con. Yeah.
And it really helped world building a great deal. She did excellent world building.
She did. And the work that she did in creating the Sword and Sorceress series, you know, set a lot of writers, you know, off on creating whole new worlds and doing some really interesting work, some of which I still like today.
Mm-hmm.
One of my all-time favorite short stories by C.J. Cherry is in one of the early Sword and Sorceress collections.
Ah, so, okay.
Yeah, it was, yeah. You know, just an amazing piece of work. Yeah. You know, it's the story that I read whenever I'm sitting there and going, wow, I wish I could write like that. That's, you know, my top 10 list.
Yeah, I have to say I was more of a C.J. Cherry fan than Marion Zimmer Bradley fan. But
understandable. I mean, Cherry's a great writer. I've never gotten into her novels quite the way I've gotten into her short fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But her short fiction, I'm in complete awe of her craftsmanship.
So. Well, that's my favorite question is going to come up at some point. And
okay.
So you've already pressed the button, so I've got to
victory!
Ask it. And I try to do this every interview, and I have this dream that I've had for 30-plus years that I'm going to take the question and go across all the interviews, find the question, and put them together. The question is short form versus long form. What do you prefer and why?
Well, for a number of years, I started writing short form. So I have, 60 or 70 short stories out in
Whoa.
The world in various publications and various genres. And
that's a nice term.
So, yeah, it was, you know, I am not unproud of this. And it's, I really like, there are things that you can do with short form where I think it's a great thing to play with. It's like painting miniatures or something. You're learning to work at this, you know, incredibly detailed level. You're learning how to condense a storyline into something that's readable in, say, 3,000 to 5,000 words or less or more than that, as the case may be. And it's a marvelous opportunity to learn a certain kind of discipline. However, there are some stories that are just going to be bigger than that. And I'm writing more and more long work. I had written a couple of novellas before I wrote this first novel. I have several other novels in progress on different themes and topics. Not all of them are werewolf related. And there's just, there's things that I think the story itself demands to be longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for some writers, you know, it's one or the other, you know, and that they have a very difficult time transitioning, either cutting themselves back or expanding, you know, how they're viewing things because it's how they write.
Mm-hmm.
And there was definitely a shift, you know, a couple of years ago when I started writing the novel to really get to the point where I could conceptualize it as, okay, no, more stuff needs to happen. It doesn't need to end here. And that's been something that I've been kind of working with, is to figure out how to get to those longer stories. The flip side of that, of course, is that there are fewer short fiction markets than there were. And I work a full-time job. So that...
And short form does not exactly earn a good living.
It does not earn a good living. It also... But it is something that fits in well if you have a limited amount of time and energy to devote to writing. So it's something that... You know, until you feel that you can handle something longer and you can commit to that, because long form is, you know, you're in it to finish it.
Yeah.
You know?
Although I think it depends on the writer. The people who I know and many of whom I respect and my partner, they write short form, but they can spend as much energy on that as other people write novels. They
mm-hmm.
write novels. They can sort of like... Because novels can be... I don't want to use the word sloppier, but they're a little freer. Whereas
mm-hmm.
in the short
yeah.
form, every word counts.
Yep. Yeah, it does. You know, for me personally, with a full-time job, it was easier for a long time to do short form.
Yeah.
The flip side of that was also that editors were asking me for short form. So I was getting hit up for stories for anthologies and different publications. And, you know, so it's, okay, write the novel that hypothetically somebody may want to see, or write the 3,000 to 5,000 words on topic X that this editor will definitely buy unless I really mess it up.
Not counting Silver Moon. Right now, what short stories would you recommend people read to get to know your writing? And are they on your website?
Yes, all of my short fiction is on my website. I've written a fair amount of erotica as well as fantasy and science fiction. And I've also written some historical romances. So the historical romances...
Not that any of these three are mutually exclusive. No. You can do all three in one.
So I do currently have three short fiction collections out. Night's Kiss and Crave are both erotica. A Day at the Inn, A Night at the Palace is not. That one is fantasy and historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about an editor named Lee Martindale when I got here earlier. And Lee did an anthology called Ladies of Trade Town, which is fantasy about sex workers. And it's not erotica. It's just that the protagonists had to be sex workers.
Yeah.
And I wrote a story called At Mother Laurie's House of Bliss, which is a closed room mystery with fantasy elements.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
So that's one thing I've got out. I've got a story out in Paula Garand's collection Obsession, which was out from Prime Books few months back.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got some things out in a couple of anthologies that Sam's Dot did. And actually, the story I'm going to read today, I'm probably going to post on my blog for free, so that'll be kind of an intro after this.
Mm.
It's just not there yet.
Okay.
So.
Well, would you like to read something now? And if so, what would you like to read?
Well... I can either read from the beginning of Blood Moon, or since I've done an intro to the short story, perhaps I should read from that.
I think that would be perfect at this point.
All right, so I'm going to read from a short story that I wrote a while back. It's a queer retelling of Edgar Allan Poe's The Cask of Amontillado, which is one of those stories that always sort of spoke to me as just amazingly dark and interesting. And I do like to play with that. I'm writing a fair amount of horror right now. I just wrote a steampunk ghost story, and I'm waiting to see what its fate turns out to be. So the story that I'm going to read from is called The Mask and the Amontillado. How does one grow to hate a man? Especially a man as universally beloved and admired as Fortunato. In a phrase, Fortunato knew things. As do we all, you may say. I, for my part, know the wines in my cellar like old friends, each with their quirks and beauties, knew them as well as I knew myself. I make no claims to know more than that. But even these small things, Fortunato claimed to know better than I. Had it begun and ended with the wines, that alone might have been enough to sour our friendship, such as it was. But there was much more than that, and for that much more, I vowed my vengeance. The thousand sights I might endure, but that he knew what I was, that was the final blow. That knowledge made him dangerous, for I was born the only child of the house of Montresor, and raised as my father's son on my mother's death. So it was that the vineyards in our palazzo might remain in Montresor hands. We made plans, he and I. My cousin Isabella was to be my bride, an adopted cousin my heir. Isabella would be the keeper of my secrets, as best a woman's tongue might keep such weighty matters. But then, was I not born a woman, too? Could I not keep my own counsel, I, and my father's as well? She would learn as I had, and all would be well once we were wed. So I thought, until Fortunato began to pay his court to her, too, showering her with a thousand little attentions, my competitor even here. And she, fickle as I was steadfast, leaned toward him like a flower in a wind. It wounded me to see it, and I was grateful that my father was no longer alive to see me fail. But it was then that I began to suspect worse things of Fortunato than that he was merely my rival in love. Isabella began to look at me askance, brown eyes questioning, then looking away before an answer could be sought. She had not looked so before. Then it had all been shy smiles behind her fan and demure glances that told me nothing more than her pride in my attentions. But all that was changed now. My mask failed me as she looked at me with questioning eyes, and the sweetness of my words faded. She suspected me, exquisite actor though I had become. And I might have wondered what she suspected me of, did I not already know? With a mind awhirl in horror, I looked to my rival, Fortunato. He, too, had begun to look upon me strangely, as though he were thinking thoughts he was not ready to reveal. I was certain that somehow he suspected what I was, and where Fortunato suspected, Fortunato's tongue must follow. The thought tortured me through a sleepless night and all of the next day. How could he suspect that I was not my father's son? I knew I had made no mistake. No, that was not true. I had made some mistake. Otherwise, Fortunato would not look at me so sly, so knowing as he did. At first, I wondered how he might have discovered me. Had I moved my hand with a delicate flutter as one would a fan? Did my feet not touch the ground firmly, as though it might all be my own? Was it the painted shadow of a beard on my cheeks, a shadow that never grew? I was my father's son. I knew as much of myself, and yet it was not enough. But why he suspected was nothing to that he suspected. To be exposed was to court death. I knew no other way to live. I could not live as a woman. I could not. Not after knowing such freedom as I had had as a man. No one would have me as wife. Not once my secret was known. I would have to find a convent far from here that might accept me of their mercy, and the house of Montresor would fall with me. And what of Isabella? My father meant for her to be mine, had spoken with her father on my behalf. Already she held half my heart. Would I lose her so easily? Would I lose the house of Montresor to such a man? Then I studied Fortunato as I would a vine, searching for his weaknesses, his secrets. I forced myself to sit at his side and invited him to dine at my table more than once. My wine touched his lips more than any other's, and I told him that each was finer than the last. And there I found his secret. He knew less of the vines and the different wines they made than he claimed, despite his boasting. Or, at least, he knew no more of them than any sot who kept a tavern. And that was enough for me. At first, I reveled in his ignorance, his boasting. This was a way in which I might recover what I feared to lose. Now, I, too, held a secret, and he might see it in my eyes if he chose to look. I thought at first to hold his tongue hostage, to threaten his reputation as one cultured and able to taste a sherry from an Amontillado. If I spoke of it, he would be a laughingstock to all who knew. He would ride through the city, hearing the laughter behind his back, feel the weight of sneering glances when he drank with those he called his friends. Then he might know the horror I had felt these last weeks. So I thought at first. And then it seemed to me to be a sufficient vengeance. I could not imagine being exposed as such a fool, not as a Montresor, trained from infancy to know the wines as old friends. He knew not even a half of what I did. I could watch him drink for hours, pouring swill down his foolish maw like a hog. It all tasted nearly the same to him, so long as it was not vinegar, and I rejoiced as I watched. But how was I to tell his secret? I realized eventually I must tell it. He was too big a fool to bargain with, and I could never trust him to keep his word as I knew that I would keep mine. For I was a son of the House of Montresor, and more of a man than Fortunato would ever be. His face began to haunt my dreams, the more I thought of exposing him. I commented on his drunkenness when he was out of hearing. I mocked him gently when we were in company. I let slip his failings to a servant or two when they fetched wine from the cellars. But it was to no avail. My hints, my jests, they vanished into the wind that spoke only of, "Good old Fortunato, our noble friend." The words would not come to my tongue when I tried to speak it to Isabella of it, and I was left, sullen and silent, while he was glib and flattering. I cannot say when the idea first came upon me. The idea to take a revenge so permanent as to remove my rival from the stage. But once it began to take root, my fevered brain allowed me no more sleep. No rest or food could I take while Fortunato roamed the streets and canals of the city, my secret on the tip of his drunken tongue. He mentioned the Montresor Amontillado, almost by accident one night. suggesting its inferiority when compared to a similar vintage from one of our rivals. It was a passing comment, one that seemed a jest. Our companions laughed, and I smiled as though I, too, could laugh at a slight to the wines of Montresor. The room spun around me, and I gripped the table, determined not to shout, not to challenge the fool who sat across from me. His leer told me all that I need know of his worth, of his thoughts. Instead, I said, "You must come and drink again of my Amontillado, Fortunato. Come next week, during the carnival. Then you may compare its true flavors to that of all the other vineyards. I think you will discover your error." My voice sounded like my father's, and I smiled as I spoke, letting his blood in my veins speak for me. Fortunato clapped his hands together like the foolish child that he was and laughed. "Once in your cellars, Montresor, I might stay there forever." And our companions laughed or smiled at his jest. I do not know what hand manipulated my features, but I know they told nothing of what I thought. Let the others think what they wished. It mattered not. I had thought of a way to stop his tongue and relieve my fears. And he, with his famed generosity of spirit, had given it to me. At that moment, I thought I might have loved Fortunato as well as any, or might have done so, did I not hate him so much. The days and nights that followed, I spent in feverish preparation. My servants were given leave to attend the carnival. The other preparations I took upon myself, that no other might know what I planned. This time, I would make no mistakes. At last, Fortunato came to the house of Montresor on the first night of the festival, dressed in a fool's motley, replete with a jester's cap and bells. My father's heart within me rejoiced to see him as he was, no more my rival, no more my friend, and naught but a fool. I would endure no more insults, no more leers. Isabella would be mine, joined to the house of Montresor once my deed was done. To say that he was drunk was not significant. He had drunk the output of a half dozen other cellars before coming to mine by his smell. He laughed uproariously as he entered my house, grabbing my shoulder for balance. Then he brought his slobbering, stinking lips to my cheek for a kiss, as he might a dear friend. "Dear, dear boy," he murmured against my shuddering flesh. "How proud your father would be were he alive to see you today." I jerked away, unwilling to hear more. My father would have thought him a fool and bid me find better companions. I thought instead of Isabella and the Amontillado. "Come, Fortunato, you are drunk," I said heartily. "Are you too drunk to recognize the true grapes when you taste them?" I shoved him away, propping him against the wall that his breath might sicken me no longer. "Montresor," he spoke my name slowly, blinking his little eyes as he tried to watch me in the candlelight. "I am not so drunk." He paused and then began again. "I am not so drunk that I do not think on you, my lad." "There is nothing to think about," I said, my heart pounding in my ears. I turned away, taking the candle with me so he was forced to follow or remain in the dark. My hand trembled a bit, then stilled when we passed before my father's portrait. He frowned down on me, his eyes seeming to lead us toward the cellar door. I took it as his blessing and guided Fortunato toward it. "Why are we in such a hurry, lad? The wine will keep." Fortunato was close behind me now. I could feel his breath on my neck, and I knew the leer that would be in his eyes without turning around to look at him. I flung the cellar door open, the blood in my veins freezing. He knew my secret. This I knew in my soul, and there was only one solution. "Come, Fortunato, you spoke vile words about the Montresor Amontillado a few nights ago, and I would have your apology after drinking a flagon of it. Then you will admit that the grapes of Montresor are the finest in the land. I will accept nothing less." I laughed, the sound cold and chill as a winter rain against my ears. My fool of a companion heard nothing as he stumbled after me, the bells on his cap jingling with each step. He was slower now, the swill he had drunk in such abundance finding its way to my head. Fat. faster. We must move faster. I could not drag his bulk through the cellar if he were to fall asleep on his feet. At last, we reached the bottom of the stairs, and I nearly ran before him, now tugging, now pushing him, into the farthest, dampest corner of the cellar. "There," I said at last, gesturing into the darkness, "there is the cask of the Amontillado that I promised you. Your flagon lies next to it. Step forth and drink, my friend." Fortunato peered into the darkness, his eyes narrowing in drunken bewilderment. "I don't see a flagon, Montresor." He stepped forward, his feet fumbling in the dark. He began to cough, a bitter, harsh, echoing sound against the walls. Then he tripped and fell. This was my chance, and without hesitation I lunged after him. The stout chain attached to the wall was in my hands in an instant, the fetter at the end attached to his wrist. I clicked it shut and scrambled away as he reached for me. "Montresor, what are you doing? Where is the wine?" I laughed, the sound filling the cellar in its turn. "The wine? The wine, you fool, is all around you. You shall stay here, Fortunato, until you too know the wines of my cellar as old friends." And with that I turned and seized the bricks I had set aside for the purpose. In moments I had them stacked as high as my knees. I could barely see Fortunato's bulk in the dark. The bells on his cap jingled softly. He lunged toward me, but was cut short by the chain and dropped to his knees, coughing. This is a fine jest, a fine jest." His voice trailed off. I raised the bricks as high as my belly, and from the darkness came Fortunato's voice again, this time soft, almost broken. "For the love of God, Montresor." I slapped more bricks in place, building the wall as fast as I could. I came to the last brick, and I paused, peering inside to see him once more. Fortunato screamed and screamed again, causing me to start and drop the brick. But I thought of my father and the palazzo and Isabella, and I found the brick again. Then I joined my voice to his, letting it climb into a woman's shrill scream so he might know who did this to him. After that, there was silence. I listened a moment, but heard nothing but the soft jingle of bells. Then the wall was done, the mortar placed, so swiftly I did not know my own handiwork. I turned and walked away, finding the stairs as my candle burned out, leaving darkness and silence behind me. I would go to Isabella's house in the morning, and I would not leave until she accepted my suit, for I was a son of the House of Montresor, and my father's blood burned in my veins, and I could do nothing less.
These are the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. Not exactly the boy next door. Tell your tales of heart, then he'll play with your mind. If you haven't heard of him, you must be dead or blind. These are the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. Not exactly the boy next door. He'll tell you about Usher, whose eyes burn in his mind. His love for his dear sister, his death would drive him wild. The murder of a stranger, the murder of a friend, the calling from the pits of hell that never seemed to end. These are the stories of Edgar Allan Poe, not exactly the boy next door. These are the stories of Edgar Allan Poe, not exactly the boy next door. Diabolic image of the city and the sea, the chaos and the carnage that reside to you within me. Decapitation, poisonings, hellish not a boy. You won't need 3D glasses to bend me on the store. Echo and the not exactly the door next door. Don't ask for idle visit, brass and naked women here. A mind on fertile, mind on bed is all we have here. Troop, rider, and gangs flooded to the stage. The expectation's home. And listen to the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. soliloquy, the raven at the door. Flame and pencil moving walls, no equilibrium, no balance, no bombast, the unvarnished truth we got. Mind swoons guiltily, cooking ravens in a pot. Edgar Allan Poe, not exactly born next door. Edgar Allan Poe, not exactly born next door. Telltale heart, erotic cast, valley of unrest, a conqueror, worm devouring soul. Keep the best for last. Bring the Annie Lee, his post buried alive, regretting his for love and death. Yeah. All the many guys. And these are the stories of Edgar and the Poe. Not exactly the boy next door. Edgar and the Poe. Not exactly the boy next door. These are the stories of Edgar and the Poe. Not exactly the boy next door.
Reading her short story, The Mask and...
The Amontillado.
The Amontillado. I almost got it there. And as I was saying, and this is our second take, the few people that I've heard get it right. I always said Amontillado because that's how Vincent Price says it.
Well, it's hard to argue with Vincent, really.
Well, yeah. It really is. He's such a happy man. And and another WBAI personality, who's Simon Locally, who's a major literary scholar, said Amontillado. But as brilliant a literary scholar as Locally is, I don't know how much he's into sherry. So that might be...
And it's actually slightly different from what we usually call sherry. And I only know this because I looked it up. I don't actually drink, so I had to go check this out because I was kind of curious. Like, what exactly is this stuff? So, yeah.
It's a little darker.
It's in the family, but yeah, it's darker. It's
a little darker than a Fino. It's lighter than most sherries. It's no, it's nowhere near a cream sherry. It's, but it's in the sherry / port /
Mm-hmm. It's on that continuum.
It's in that continuum. It's a fortified wine.
Ah,
is
what
nice, it
is. Nice way of putting
said
it.
The former bartender and liquor store stock boy. You know, not that as a stock boy you have to know this stuff, but
generally no.
Yeah,
and we're no doubt very good at it. So,
oh well, not really. I was a great book stock boy. I was a great stock boy at the science fiction shop. At the liquor store, not so much.
Ah, okay.
But you know, book stock boy. There's a job for you, or for me anyway.
I actually used to be a bookstore owner, so.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about that.
Well, I had my own bookstore in Iowa City for a couple of years. It was feminist, progressive politics, you know, queer stuff, and some science fiction and fantasy. And I did that for a couple of years as kind of a quasi collective venture. I owned it, but had a committee of people who helped me with it. And I also have been part of a couple of collectively run bookstores, one in St. Louis and one in the Twin Cities. So I've spent a lot of time peddling some of my favorite titles and talking to people about books.
Yeah, working bookstores, it's just so much fun.
Yeah.
And even if books move to e-books or whatever, we have to have the bookstore atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And not just, you know, conventions don't do it because that's the already sold. It's the people who walk in and say, what should I read and all that, and that's the fun of a bookstore.
One of the things I like about conventions is that, particularly if you're on panels, you've got the opportunity to recommend a lot of things that people in the audience might not otherwise run across.
Yeah, yeah. And especially when you're talking about short stories. Which mm-hmm. we were earlier, because even mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one thing to talk about the latest book. It's another to say, okay, here are short stories you probably just haven't come across because you don't subscribe to every literary journal or every zine in the country.
Well, I mean, but you've also got the opportunity to recommend small press books, you know, niche market books, you know, other kinds of books that may not come to the attention of, you know, the average audience that's attending a panel at a convention. Not, it's kind of difficult to talk about an average audience in that context, but if you can imagine such a thing.
Yeah, but exactly. Yeah. But I guess what I tend to like are stuff that isn't for the average audience. So there you have it. And especially when you start getting into the sub-genres of queer science. I don't like any of these terms. This is a generational problem. The
LGBTQ is pretty standard right now.
Yeah, it is, but it sounds like...
There's also quilt bag, which I'm not keen on because it sounds like little scraps. But conveys the general idea.
Yeah, actually, I prefer that a little bit. Okay. I mean, because the first one sounds like a sandwich. And the second one was nothing but a derogatory term when I was growing up. And because of, and I'm not one of those people that think that you can buy a term back or re-own a term. To me, every time I hear it, a hackle. This is a generational thing because... For other people, they've grown up with that term. Mm-hmm. They have owned it. Yeah. And you know what? That's fine for them. But it sticks in my throat when I say it.
Yeah. I mean, I came out during, you know, a time when Queer Nation and ACT UP were very active. So it's actually what I call myself. But I also use it interchangeably with other terms.
Yeah, but you see, I go after science fiction writers and the like, saying queer. Mm-hmm. Queer is what you find in a Clark Ashton Smith story.
And, you know, and I can see that. So,
or when you have to take a promo.
If we can settle on quilt bag, we'll settle on quilt bag.
I've never heard that one before.
Yeah, that's one I've seen gaining credence.
That's one so. I can buy. I can buy Rainbow. I've got a little... rainbow sign hanging over there. It's just words do mean something.
Mm-hmm.
But there's the problem that they mean different things to different generational, but to different experiences.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. So, and there's actually, by the way, a sporadic queer SF reading series starting up in New York. So
cool.
I have this fellow, Sam Miller. He did the first one. He did like, you know, 8 writers, and I told him, no, you know, do 2 and do 4 readings of 2.
Yeah.
Give people a chance to, you know, spread their wings and really show people what they're stories are about. And then I finally had to say the queer SF, and he was so sweet. He said basically just, thank you, Jim, for speaking out of your comfort zone, outside of your comfort zone, which is exactly right. You know, it's not interior comfort zone, it's the word.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah.
What have you had problems publishing? It's weird because science fiction can be an extremely conservative field, which is weird, another word, for a kind of writing. And when I say science fiction, of course, I mean fantasy and horror and all of it. It's weird to find so much conservatism in a genre that is supposed to be about opening the worlds, going to places outside of your comfort zone, outside of new things, and yet it's so conservative. Why is that?
Well, I think that, you know, there's certainly a tendency toward ancestor worship within the genre, and the notion that if it was good enough in the 40s, it's good enough today. And I think that the genre is changing a lot, and I think that we'll gradually get away from that. But I go to a lot of conventions, and we have some conventions where, you know, in some cases, until recently, I was the youngest person at them, which is kind of amazing because I'm definitely not the youngest person in the room. And there's other conventions where, you know, there's tons and tons of young people A couple of years ago, I was one of the guests at ACON, which is a manga and anime convention in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
They had there used to be a New York con called ACON, or actually Connecticut.
It's been around for, I think, a little under 10 years, but I might be wrong about that.
Mine was 40 years ago.
Okay.
And it was called ACON because somebody said, let's have ACON.
This is A-K-O-N. And, they had it was amazing. And they had a writing track with Peter Beagle and Esther Friesner and, Lynn Abbey and, you know, a bunch of other folks. And it was, you know, it was very interesting. And, of course, because there are 16,000 people, they, you know, had Abney Park, who's one of the big steampunk bands, playing their Saturday night concert. And it was a blast. I had a really great time. But it's probably the only convention I've been to where over 75% of the attendees were under the age of 25.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a very different energy.
Steampunk is a young...
Well, it's steampunk, it's manga, it's anime, it's media.
But the media aside, those other things are all young people's genres, I would say, including steampunk.
They're younger. Steampunk, I think, is one that spreads itself well, I think, across the generations. Manga and anime, mixed results. It really depends on the series and the environment of the convention.
I haven't been able to go there.
I like some stuff very much. Most of it is a bit too long for my attention span.
Yeah.
You know, there'll be like 20 books in a series to get to the ultimate finale, and I lose interest along about four.
I'll give a challenge to the audience that's listening now. If you can name the anime that or manga that you think will change me and turn me into a fan, write me.
Try ROD. It's Read or Die. And it's this sort of odd little series. It's only about, I think, 7 or 8 CDs long, which is pretty short for an anime series. And it's about these young women who are book collectors, and they're running around Tokyo, and they're involved in this obscure plot by the British Library to take over the world. And, you know, I'm sort of mashing some elements together, but it's worth checking out. I think you might like it.
Yeah, I'll give that a try.
Try Read or Die.
Yeah, the other one that some friends have recommended, and it's on my queue, is Millennium Actress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they know that I like Japanese movies, real Japanese movies.
Yes. Live Japanese movies.
That's the one. Where are you going? You have the first part of a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
I assume, judging from talking to you, that's not the only place you're going.
I've got several books in progress right now, and I'm actually working on another novel that's been requested by an acquisitions editor at a different house. That one, when I get it done, is probably going to be under another name. Largely because when I started out, I was writing erotica, I was writing science fiction and fantasy, I was writing historicals, and it was before Google, and I work in IT, and it's a little stressful when people have gone out and Googled your name and bought one of your erotica collections, they brought it to work, and they want you to sign it. It's lovely, but at the same time, it's sort of one of those moments where you sit there and go, ooh, are we having an HR moment? I'm not sure. Are they going to have an HR moment when they actually read this? I don't know. I think that, you know, anything with a lot of graphic sex in it is going to go under my new name. And that's,
That's probably a smart thing.
It's
just
time.
To keep them keep them apart. There's a very popular romance writer by the name of Alyssa Quitney. And she Harlequin type stuff, and she sells very well and all that. And she had been booked into the reading series that isn't mine. Well, now there's three reading series in New York because Jen Brissett has started the Kindred reading series, which is just people of color, which is so far she hasn't had a brilliant one yet. They're all great. Okay, so...
Okay.
Double negatives will get you every time. And the other reading series is the one put on by Ellen Datlow and Matt Kressel, and I run the New York Review Censor. Okay. So Datlow books Alyssa Quitney, and I'm thinking, who the heck is this? And we'll have a point in a moment. And I look her up, and I see she's got all of this stuff, and she comes in, and They were talking about the old days at Omni magazine. I'm going, huh? I'm trying to figure that out. Mm-hmm. You know, when apparently Datlow would deal with Alyssa Quitney when Alyssa was a little girl. And she gets up and she said, I'm going to read from my new novel, which is about a werewolf her becoming a werewolf coincides mm-hmm. with her menstrual cycle and all that. But I'm going to do this under my real name, Alyssa Sheckley. This is Robert Sheckley's daughter. Robert Sheckley being the editor of Omni when Ellen Datlow was the fiction editor of right. Omni. And little Alyssa used to run in into Ellen Datlow's office and prevent her from working or something like that.
Yes.
And I just thought that was such a... And by the way, it was a very Sheckley-esque piece, a woman's piece, mm-hmm. which means very not Robert Sheckley. But it was very Alyssa Sheckley. The name, it's like the torch has been passed on.
Huh. I'll have to look for that.
But she's also very careful not to use the same name.
Yeah.
For the two yeah. genres. So there was yeah. actually a point to my stealing your airtime here.
I'll be moving in that direction. But yeah, so I'm working on the next, werewolf novel, and then I've got a couple of other things kicking around that I'm thinking of reviving. So.
Uh-huh. Any historic fiction?
Actually, there is. I was thinking, I had written a short story a while ago, and it's about there was a real female pirate, one of the real female pirates from the Caribbean in the 16th century.
Yeah.
So Jacques de la Haye, who I wanted to play with more.
Right.
And so I'd started writing a story about a French agent who's sort of like a little bit like Milady from the Three Musketeers and the pirate and how they end up working together. And so I'm kind of messing with that one around. So the short story is called The Letter of Mark, and it's in one of my short fiction collections. And a couple of people have, written me and have read the book and pinged me and said, so this one, could there be more of it?
Oh, yeah, that does sound like fun.
So
yeah.
I'm probably going to play with that. That's kind of next on the agenda.
Yeah. So we're near the end, but mm-hmm. did you want to read any more?
Well, I could read the first couple of pages of Blood Moon.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking, because that's also we're talking about what's forthcoming.
Yes.
And this is a book that, as of right now, is forthcoming, unless you're listening to a podcast of this show, and it was in the past already, and a bestseller and all that good stuff.
Not quite, not yet.
Yeah, well, not yet, but remember, this is a podcast in the future.
Okay, I'm going to read a little bit from the first chapter of Blood Moon, which is the new werewolf novel that I'm working on. And it starts out with a murder mystery. And again, this is also about werewolves. So we have a pack of werewolves, all of whom are menopausal women. And they're living in a town called Wolf's Point. And Aaron Adams is the pack beta. And Becca Thornton is the protagonist from the first novel, Silver Moon, which is out today. Chapter 1. Aaron Adams looked at the mountains and tried not to think about what was in the trunk of her car. At least the mountains around Wolf's Point were still as beautiful as ever. She wondered if she'd ever get the chance to run through them again, feel the wind in her fur, the ground flying by under her paws, the pack at her side. That thought was enough to make her look back at her car. Erin rubbed her aching forehead with one hand and closed her eyes. This was, without question, the worst thing she'd ever done, even if she couldn't remember doing it. But maybe there was still time to call Shelley and get her help to figure a way out of this mess that she'd blundered into. That was what pack alphas did, or so Shelley always told her. But that might make Shelley an accessory if they got caught. When she got caught. The pack couldn't afford to be without its alpha so soon after they got her back, not to mention what it would do to Pete and the kids. Maybe there was someone else. Her thoughts turned to Becca, waded through a jumbled mess of emotions, and came back with a single realization. They'd suspect her first. Becca was her friend, her housemate, her something they still hadn't defined, but which felt more like girlfriend every day. Her stomach did a slow, leisurely flip when she thought about that, and she almost smiled. But this wasn't the time to think about Becca. She couldn't afford to be distracted, to be vulnerable. Not now. Maybe there was another solution, a way to hide what had happened. But that would leave her to carry the burden of what she'd done, alone. And what if the body was found? The regular wolves would probably get blamed for it. One of their senators was already pushing for a hunting season on wolves. This would put things right over the top. She couldn't think of any other pack member who'd be able to do anything about this, not more than she could do herself anyway. And it wasn't the kind of thing she could call her sponsor about. So she was on her own. There was nothing for it but to lie on the bed she'd made for herself. She pulled her cell phone out of her pocket and dialed a number. "Hi, it's Aaron. I've done something. I need, can you come up to Spruce Point?" "Yes, it's important. I want you to see it before Sheriff Henderson does." She clicked off the phone and glanced toward the road. Nothing to do now but wait. And I'll end that there.
Oh, the werewolf, oh, the werewolf, come to steppin' along. He don't even break the branches where he's been gone. You can hear his long holler from way across the moor. That's the holler of the werewolf when he's feeling poor. He goes out in the evening when the bats are on the wing, and he's killed some young maiden before the birds sing. For the werewolf, for the werewolf, have sympathy, 'cause the werewolf is someone just like you and me. Once I saw him in the moonlight when the bats were a-flying. All alone I saw the werewolf, and the werewolf was crying. Crying nobody, nobody, nobody knows how much I love the maiden as I tear off her clothes. Crying nobody, nobody knows of my pain. When I see it has risen, that full moon again. When I see that moon moving through the clouds in the sky, I get a crazy feeling and I wonder why. Thank you. Oh, the werewolf comes traveling along. He don't even break the branches where he's been gone. For the werewolf, have pity, not fear, not hate. 'Cause the werewolf might be someone that you've known of late. Oh, the werewolf comes traveling along. He don't even crush the leaves where he's been gone.
That was nice. That was nice, I guess. So people now have an official tease.
I do try.
So, where do people find you online? And how can they, there must be opportunities where they can meet you at signings or at conventions.
Yes. My website is katherinelundhoff.com.
Let's spell that.
And that's CATHERINE. LUNDOFF as in Frank .com.
Okay.
And I've got social media presence on Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus. The next convention that I will be at is actually going to be WisCon, which is Memorial Day weekend in Madison, Wisconsin. And I'll be doing readings, and I will be on programming, and I will be working the Broad Universe table, so I will be really findable. And
are you at a lot of the cons where Broad Universe does their thing?
Primarily the ones in the Midwest. So
that's why we don't see you here enough.
That's why you don't see me here.
You're grumbled.
Yeah. So I do a lot of the regional conventions. So I'll be at 4th Street Fantasy in Minneapolis. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm one of the guests at Diversicon this year in St. Paul. And there's also a large...
Diversicon sounds like fun.
Diversicon is a lot of fun. Jack McDevitt is the headlining guest of honor, and I'm one of the second tier guests of honor, along with Roy Booth, who's a playwright and horror writer from the northern Minnesota area.
Yeah, I've actually heard of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He does a lot of plays, and
Jack McDevitt, I'm very fond of.
Yes, a lot of people are very excited that he's going to be there. So I'm looking forward to a great con. I think that'll be really fun. I'm also one of the attending professionals at Convergence, which is a roughly 5,000 person convention over 4th of July weekend in the Twin Cities. Yeah. We have a lot of really good conventions, so if you're thinking of venturing away from the East Coast.
Minneapolis has always been a center for good cons for some reason. I used to go to Minicon years ago. It was my favorite one. And Jim Young was sort of the ambassador of Minneapolis fandom for many a year. He would actually go to both coasts and pull people
Recruit.
To Minneapolis. Yep. I met Clifford D. Simak at a mini con. Talk about sitting at a table with Clifford D. Simak, Poole Anderson, and Gordon R. Dixon.
Before my time, alas, when I moved up to the Twin Cities, it was still kind of the tail end.
This is like 74.
Yeah, well before my time.
Yeah, so it was at least 3 years ago. Yeah. So at any rate, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you say you come to New York at least once a year, so we're going to have you on the air at least once a year.
I'm for it.
Good. Next time maybe live so we can do phone calls.
Okay. All right, I'll look forward to that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Katherine Lundhoff here over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored
non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And again, Catherine's website may be found at, well, CatherineLundoff.com. There's a novel one. That's CatherineLundoff.com. And I hope that you enjoyed that, and we will surely be having her back on the air. Something I forgot to mention. There is a little video documentary out about me, of all things. It's available on YouTube, and it's all about, well, my tape collections and how problematic it is for me to take the archives that I have going back to Bear Searles' era in the 1960s and Hour of the Wolf starting 1972, and all the things that I've recorded that are on magnetic media, and how to bring them into a digital world and possibly get them online, get them heard, probably for free, seems to be the most likely way of handling it. But yeah, it's an issue. It's a hassle. And Cesar Bustamante, who I had met at, I think it was actually a KGB reading, did a piece for a website called Narratively. Also, there were some inserts and additional stuff done by a fellow by the name of Iman Hassan. It's E-M-O-N-H-A-S-S-A-N, who not only knew his science fiction, but knew his radio drama, has produced a whole bunch of stuff. And they did this documentary. It's about 4 minutes long, which they've called Inside the Wolf's Den, for a website called Narratively, and that's narrative.ly. And they put this on /gamers-geeks/inside the wolf's den with hyphens in between. The easiest way to get it, the easiest thing to do, is to go to Facebook and either look up the Narratively group there or visit my, what are they calling it now? Timeline wall, time wall, something along those lines. And there's a link to it there. Inside the Wolf's Den by Cesar Bustamante, Narratively Local Stories, etc., etc. And it's rather charming. I enjoyed it. It's not because it's about me. It was just very well done. And a lot of the videos on that website are, in fact, entertaining. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon. Have a great 2 weeks. Good morning.
And you're in tune to radio station WBAI, WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI New York. WBAI.org. 2 minutes to four, 2 minutes to three.
The New York Society for Ethical Culture presents an advocacy forum on Wednesday, April 24th at 7 p.m., featuring Susan Jacoby, author of The Great and Gnostic, interviewed by Massimino Pellucci. The Great and Gnostic, Robert Greene Ingersoll, raise his voice on behalf of enlightenment, reason, secularism, and the separation of church and state. That's Wednesday, April 24th at 7 p.m. at the New York Society for Ethical Culture, 2 West 64th Street in Manhattan. For more information, go to nysec.org or call 212-874-5210.
Children, this is Reverend Billy from the Church of Stop Shopping. You're listening to WBAI FM 99.5, New York City. It's listener sponsored, children. It's commercial free. Ooh, change-a-looia.
On Sunday, April 14th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature award-winning poet, playwright, essayist, and recording artist, Carl Hancock Rux. Join us as we discuss many things, including upcoming Apollo Theater dates and his latest release, Homeostasis. That's Sunday, April 14th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
When I leave, you can know I said with the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary, and you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the best. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. And drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest. And
watch me burn that beast up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one, Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag.
Number one.
That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Nine Sinker, WBAI, 7 minutes after 3 o'clock. This is Burn, Baby Burn. Clappers, we do this until 4 o'clock, y'all. Yeah.
Brothers on the slide, working on the wrong side. What you gonna do? You can't win, so you know you must lose. We know which way you're going. We know which way you're going. Brothers on the slide, what you gonna hide? Wrecking your folks' name. But in no game, we know which way you're going. We know which way you're going.
Slowly sliding,
we're doing all that we can.
Slowly sliding.
inside. Know what they'll do to you. Make you pay up all you do. We know which way you're going.
Thank you very much, Simande, you know? Yeah, one day I'll tell the true history behind that group called Simande, yeah. Lister.
Avant ne parler pas de Nordis, ni de Sudis, mais aujourd'hui, tout est gâté. L'armée est divisée, les étudiants sont divisés, la société est divisée, même nos maires au marché sont divisés. Oh Lord, mon pays va mal, mon pays va mal, mon pays va mal, de mal en mal, mon pays va mal. Avant ne parlait pas de chrétiens, ni de musulmans, mais aujourd'hui, ils ont tout gâté. L'armée est divisée. Les étudiants sont divisés. La société est divisée. Même maman au marché sont divisés. Oh Lord, mon pays va mal. Mon pays va mal. Mon pays va mal. De mal. Le tribalisme, la